and the young author leaves the French capital behind him and makes for home, where a friend has tipped him off about the possibility of a job.
I travelled to England third class via Dunkirk and Tilbury. On the journey, I fell in with a couple of Romanians, mere children, who were going to England on their honeymoon trip. They asked innumerable questions about England, and I told them some startling lies. I was so pleased to be getting home after being hard up for months in a foreign city that England seemed to me a sort of paradise. There are indeed many things in England that make you glad to get home. Bathrooms, armchairs, mint sauce, new potatoes, brown bread, marmalade, they're all splendid if you can pay for them. England's a very good country when you're not poor. And of course, with the promise of a job, I wasn't going to be poor. The thought made me very patriotic. The more questions the Romanians asked, the more I praised England. The climate, the scenery, the literature, the laws, everything was perfect. Was the architecture in England good? The Romanians asked. Splendid, I said. Paris is vulgar, half grandiosity and half slums. Oh, but London! Then the boat drew alongside Tilbury Pier. The first building we saw on the waterside was one of those huge hotels, all stucco and pinnacles, which stare from the English coast like idiots staring over an asylum wall. I saw the Romanians, too polite to say anything, cocking their eyes at the hotel. Built by French architects, I assured them. In London, I went to my friend B's office, and his first words knocked everything to ruins. I'm sorry, your employers have gone abroad. However, they'll be back in a month. I suppose you can hang on till then? I was outside in the street before it even occurred to me to borrow some money. I had exactly 19 and 6 pence in hand. For a long time, I couldn't make up my mind what to do. I loafed the day in the streets, and at night, not having the slightest notion of how to get a cheap bed in London, I went to a family hotel, where the charge was 7 and 6 pence. After paying the bill, I had 10 and 2 pence in hand. By the morning, I'd made my plans. I'd leave all my things at the station cloakroom, except my second-best suit, which I could exchange for some cheap clothes and perhaps a pound. If I was going to live a month on 30 shillings, I must have bad clothes. Indeed, the worse the better. To sell my clothes, I went down into Lambeth, where the people are poor and there are a lot of rag shops. At the first shop I tried, the proprietor was polite but unhelpful. At the second, he was rude. At the third, he was stone deaf, or pretended to be so. The fourth shopman was a large, blonde young man, very pink all over, like a slice of ham. He looked at the clothes I was wearing and felt them disparagingly between thumb and finger. Poor stuff. Very, very poor stuff. It was quite a good suit. What you want from? I explained that I wanted some older clothes and as much money as he could spare. He thought for a moment, then collected some dirty-looking rags and threw them onto the counter. What about the money? I said, hoping for a pound. He pursed his lips, then produced a shilling and laid it beside the clothes. I didn't argue. I was going to, but as I opened my mouth, he reached out as though to take up the shilling again. I saw that I was helpless. He let me change in a small room behind the shop. The clothes were a coat, once dark brown, a pair of black dungaree trousers, a scarf, and a cloth cap. I'd kept my own shirt, socks, and boots, and I had a comb and razor in my pocket. It gives one a very strange feeling to be wearing such clothes. I'd worn bad enough things before, but nothing at all like these. They weren't merely dirty and shapeless, they had... How is one to express it? A gracelessness. A patina of antique filth. Quite different from mere shabbiness. They were the sort of clothes you see on a bootlace seller. An hour later, in Lambeth, I saw a hangdog man, obviously a tramp, coming towards me, And when I looked again, it was myself, reflected in a shop window. The dirt was plastering my face already. Dirt is a great respecter of persons. It lets you alone when you're well-dressed, but as soon as your collar's gone, it flies towards you from all directions. I stayed in the streets till late at night, keeping on the move all the time. Dressed as I was half afraid that the police might arrest me as a vagabond, and I dared not speak to anyone, imagining that they must notice a disparity between my accent and my clothes. But later I discovered that this never happened. My new clothes had put me instantly into a new world. Everyone's demeanour seemed to have changed abruptly. I helped a hawker pick up a barrow that he'd upset, and he grinned, "Thanks, mate." No one had called me mate before in my life. It was the clothes that had done it. For the first time I noticed, too, how the attitude of women varies with a man's clothes. When a badly dressed man passes them, they shudder away from him with a quite frank movement of disgust, as though he were a dead cat. Clothes are powerful things. Dressed in a tramp's clothes, it's very difficult, at any rate for the first day, not to feel that you are genuinely degraded. At about 11, I began looking for a bed. I'd read about doss houses, and I supposed that one could get a bed for fourpence or thereabouts. Seeing a navvy standing in the Waterloo Road, I told him that I was stony broke and wanted the cheapest bed I could get.
"Oh, you go to that house across the street there with the sign, 'Good Beds for Single Men.' That's a good kip. I've been there myself on and off. You'll find it cheap and clean."
It was a tall, battered-looking house with dim lights in the windows, some of which were patched with brown paper. I entered a stone passageway, and a boy with sleepy eyes appeared from a door leading to a cellar.
"Want a kip? That'll be an og, guv'nor."
I paid the shilling, and the boy led me up a rickety staircase to a bedroom. It had a sweetish reek of paregoric and foul linen, and the air was almost suffocating. There was a candle burning, and I saw that the room measured 15 feet square and had 8 beds in it. Already 6 lodgers were in bed, queer, lumpy shapes with all their own clothes, even their boots, piled on top of them. Someone was coughing in a loathsome manner in one corner. When I got into the bed, I found that it was as hard as a board, and as for the pillow, it was like a block of wood. It was worse than sleeping on a table, as the mattress was convex, so that one had to hold on to avoid falling out. The sheets stank so horribly of sweat that I couldn't bear them near my nose. About once an hour, the man on my left, a sailor, I think, woke up, swore vilely and lighted a cigarette. Another man, victim of bladder disease, got up and noisily used his chamber pot 6 times during the night. The man in the corner had a coughing fit every 20 minutes, so regularly that one came to listen for it, as one listens for the next yap when a dog is baying the moon. It was an unspeakably repellent sound, a foul bubbling and retching. Every time he coughed or the other man swore, a sleepy voice from one of the other beds cried out,
"Shut up! Oh, for Christ's sake, shut up!"
I had about an hour's sleep in all. In the morning I was woken by a dim impression of some large brown thing coming toward me. I opened my eyes and saw that it was one of the sailor's feet, sticking out of bed close to my face. It was dark brown with dirt. I got up, dressed, and went downstairs. In the cellar were a row of basins and 2 slippery roller towels. I had a piece of soap in my pocket, and I was going to wash when I noticed that every basin was streaked with grime. Solid, sticky filth as black as boot blacking. I went out unwashed. Altogether, the lodging house hadn't come up to its description as cheap and clean. It was, however, as I found later, a fairly representative lodging house. I crossed the river and walked into a coffee shop on Tower Hill. An ordinary London coffee shop, like 1,000 others. It seemed queer and foreign after Paris. The day's menu was written on a mirror with a piece of soap. Navvies were eating out of newspaper parcels and drinking tea in vast saucerless mugs. Could I have some tea and bread and butter? The serving girl stared at me in surprise.
No butter, only marge.
Then she repeated the order in a phrase that is to London what the eternal coup de rouge is to Paris.
Large tea in two slices!
The 8 shillings lasted 3 days and 4 nights. After my bad experience in the Waterloo Road, I moved eastward and spent the next night in a lodging house in Pennyfields. It had accommodation for between 50 and 100 men and was managed by a deputy. We slept 15 or 20 in a dormitory. The beds were again cold and hard, but the sheets not more than a week from the wash, which was an improvement. The charge was 9 pence, and the terms were cashed down by 7 in the evening, or out you went. Downstairs was a kitchen, common to all lodgers, with 2 great clinker fires, which were kept burning day and night. The work of the kitchen, tending the fires, sweeping and making the beds, was done by the lodgers in rotation. One senior lodger, a stevedore named Steve, was known as head of the house and was the arbiter of disputes and unpaid chucker-out. I liked the kitchen. It was hot and drowsy, with coke fumes and lighted by the fires which cast black, velvet shadows in the corners. Ragged washing hung on strings from the ceiling. Red-lit men, stevedores mostly, moved about with cooking pots. Some of them were quite naked, for they'd been laundering and were waiting for their clothes to dry. At night there were games of draughts and songs. I'm a man, what's done wrong by my parents, was a favourite. There was a general sharing of food, and it was taken for granted to feed men who were out of work. A pale, wizened creature, obviously dying, referred to as Poor Brown, been under the doctor and cut open 3 times, was regularly fed by the others. Some of the lodgers were old-age pensioners. Till meeting them, I'd never realised that there are people in England who live on nothing but the old-age pensions of 10 shillings a week. I wondered how they managed. One told me, "Well, there's 9 pence a night for your kip, that's 5 and 3 pence a week. Then there's 3 pence on Saturdays for a shave, that's 5 and 6. Then say you has a haircut once a month for 6 pence, that's another 3 halfpence a week, so you has about 4 and 4 pence for food and bacca." He could imagine no other expenses. His food was bread and margarine and tea. Towards the end of the week, dry bread and tea without milk. And perhaps he got his clothes from charity. He seemed contented, valuing his bed and the fire more than food. But with an income of 10 shillings a week, to spend money on a shave, it's awe-inspiring.
Joseph Milson has been reading Down and Out in Paris and London. The series was abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions for BBC Radio 4. Visit the Radio 4 website for extra features on Orwell's life and work and details of the rest of our season of programmes.